Exodus chapter 20. This is one of the most widely known portions of the Old Testament. This is the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments, which is not just the title of the famous Moses movie starring Charlton Heston, nor is the Ten Commandments just kind of this center of controversy piece that they have been, seems like, for decades now, particularly in the U.S. I think there was even some major battles that went on in the state of Alabama. I don't know how long it's been, a decade or so ago, about the place or the display or the lack of display of the Ten Commandments. Should they be displayed in courthouses and school buildings? Should they not be displayed in those places? This is the controversy that was happening and the discussion that was happening. A lot of heated opinions on both sides of that controversy. I always wanted to say that there needed to be a prerequisite that if you were a proponent and argued for the placement of the Ten Commandments, that you needed to at least be able to stand and cite the Ten Commandments, right? You need to at least know what they were. Sometimes I felt like in the midst of that, there were people arguing that probably didn't even know the Ten Commandments. But anyways, we'll talk about some of that. Not as much today as next week. We're going to spend 2 weeks in the Ten Commandments. And so the purpose of today is not that controversy. Our goal is to walk through the text together. I want to give you kind of some preliminary thoughts before we jump into the actual Ten Commandments. And they are grounded in the very first two verses of Exodus chapter 20, which is the prologue or the kind of preface of the Ten Commandments themselves. So Exodus chapter 20, and God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You can't begin to break down the Ten Commands before you understand these two verses. These two verses are the most important verses of all of the Ten Commandments passage. This prologue establishes the foundation by which the commandments should be viewed, by which they should be lived out. The commandments, and we talked about this at the end of the message last week, I'll emphasize it again today, and we'll talk about it from a different angle next week. The Ten Commandments follow God's redemption. They follow God's deliverance of His people. So do the math with me. The Exodus happened first, deliver out of Egypt. Exodus first. And now we're at Mount Sinai. That happened second. Exodus first, deliverance first, salvation first, rescue first, redemption first, Sinai second. God's instructions, God's law happened after the Exodus. God delivers them, and then He instructs them. The Ten Commandments are for God's people, for God's people, the ones who have been rescued and redeemed. They are to whom the instructions have been given, that God rescued you. God rescued you. You are a redeemed people. Now live like it. The Ten Commands help define what the life of the redeemed look like. That's so important in this conversation and even that whole controversy about whether they should or should not be displayed. You see, the Ten Commandments are not just kind of these moral platitudes or these virtuous instructions. The Ten Commandments are not just advice on how to win God's favor. The purpose of the Ten Commandments is not to make us nice people. Do you hear me? The purpose of the Ten Commandments is not to make us better citizens or morally superior. God has been very forthright in the entire book of Exodus that His purpose for the deliverance of His people is to show His supremacy, to show His superiority over all other gods, false gods, to show His sovereign grace to a chosen people who would reflect His image and proclaim His message of redemption to the world. That was the purpose of God's deliverance from the very beginning. That God has a claim on His people, that He delivered them from slavery. He brought them out of Egypt based on who He is, not based on who they are, not based on that they deserved it, right? That they were special in some way. God just sheer grace redeemed, chose them out of Egypt to be His people. He claimed them as His own, and now He instructs them on how to live as His chosen people, not to earn His favor, but as a result of His favor. a result of his grace. You see, God's commands are lived out on the basis of grace, not as a condition for grace. It needs to be said again. God's commands are lived out on the basis of his grace, not as a condition for his grace. Obedience, we said it this way last week, obedience flows out of redemption, out of deliverance. The Israelites have already been rescued, already been saved. God has set his affection on them, and now God is shaping them. He is forming them. And God, before he gets to the Big Ten, God's like, hey, no, I am the Lord who brought you out of Egypt. I delivered you. I rescued you. I redeemed you from slavery. The Ten Commandments are not simply good rules to live by. It's not like, all right, now we have our top 10 list. We know what to do to please God. We know how to be nice people. The Ten Commandments reveal things about who God is, the nature of God. They inform us of who God is, what he's done, and how we respond in response to his rescue. This is an illustration I'm going to use that has its limits, but I think it helps us kind of understand what I'm getting at here. Think of the Ten Commandments as kind of the way that we think in terms of the United States Constitution, okay? The Constitution of the United States, which you can go and view along with the Declaration of Independence in Washington, D.C., in the upper level of the National Archives Museum. Are you impressed that I know that? Upper level, National Archives Museum. That is what houses the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States. Google told me that this morning. I have seen these documents, the actual original documents, and I have an illegal picture of them. Because when you go in, it's like, don't take any pictures. Don't get your phone out. I'm like, whatever, dude. Take a picture of my... And I got like the look from the person beside me. How dare you? So I have on my phone a picture of the original, if you'd like to see it, illegally. The Constitution of the United States. What is the purpose of the Constitution? The Constitution is kind of this foundational bedrock from which other federal laws emerge, right? It's our foundational document. It is the most basic, legally binding document that is upheld by our highest court of law, the Supreme Court. Their job is to see whatever comes their way, how it lines up with the Constitution of the United States. They uphold the highest legal document. But there are multitudes of other sections of federal law that deal with all sorts of matters that flow out of the Constitution of the United States. So think of the Ten Commandments kind of in those terms. These Big Ten, they serve as kind of this foundational bedrock upon which all these other laws that God will give kind of flow out of. As a matter of fact, we'll see when we get to chapter 21, that the very first verse is God saying, these are the rules that you should set before them. And it's based on what he's just told Moses, the foundational Ten Commandments. So for the next 2 weeks, we'll look at each of these commands. Technically, we use the word Ten Commandments, but the word commandments is nowhere in this text. It's actually the ten words that God gave, the word that God spoke. We've kind of defined them as the Ten Commandments. Matter of fact, if you have a Bible, it's got little notes. It probably says somewhere there, the Ten Commandments. But these are the ten words of God, foundational words of God to his people. And we're going to look at these with these kind of two thoughts in mind. What does the command mean? What does the word mean? And what does it teach us about God? Because that's kind of the foundation of all this. What does it mean? What does it teach us about God? So commandment number one is verse 3. Pretty simple, straightforward, foundational statement. Verse 3, you shall have no other gods before me. You shall have no other gods before me. This first command is paramount because it gets to the heart of what it means to be God's people. You're my people. You shall have no other gods. No other gods. I am the only true God. That's foundational to everything God's going to give them. I'm the Lord your God. You are my people. So it's foundational because it addresses that most fundamental thing. And then it also reminds us that the deepest problem of the human heart is idolatry. That we tend to put other gods on the pedestal. And God says, because God has rescued the Israelites, They are to have no other gods. Now, catch this. You shall have no other gods before me. You should not have any other gods. Now, this is not so much because Israel owes their loyalty to God as some sort of payback for his deliverance. The reason they have no other gods before them is because he's the only God. He's the only true God. And he is worthy of their devotion and worship. So it's not like, hey, remember the whole I bailed you out of Egypt thing? You shouldn't have any other gods. No, this is more like, I am God. I'm the only true God. There are no other gods. And so you should have no other gods before me. I am worthy of your devotion and worship. Now, this first command inherently obviously addresses atheism. It says there is no God. And this first command says there is a God. And it also addresses the idea of that culture, which was polytheism, the belief in many gods. And God is saying, no, there is only one God and no other gods. And this first command reminds us about who God is, that God is sovereign, God is unique. He is the one and only true God. There is no one like him. He is worthy of our absolute devotion. He is worthy of our absolute worship. Let's talk about that second aspect. Idolatry is a heart issue. I've told you this before at City Church. We are worshipers of someone. We are worshipers of something. You are by your very nature a worshiper. You are worshiping something or someone. Every moment of every day, something or someone sits on the throne of your heart. We are worshipers by nature. And idolatry, we love to think of it in terms of bowing down to some metal or gold or silver image. Idolatry is putting something or someone on the throne of our heart other than God. That's what spiritual idolatry is. Most often for us, these are good things that we make into ultimate things. We addressed this a couple weeks ago, we tend to take the good and gracious gifts of God and elevate them in a place in our heart and life for which they were never intended. We tend to put them on the throne of our heart, to make idols out of them, making good things the ultimate things, allowing them to sit on the thrones of our heart. As we follow Christ, it's important to recognize our idols for what they are. Our idols are these shallow attempts to try and find joy or fulfillment or satisfaction or meaning or purpose in something or someone other than God. Man, we're so guilty of this, aren't we? Trying to find our fulfillment, our joy, our happiness, our contentment in something or someone other than God. And again, most of the time, these are good things in our life. The devil is deceptive. It's not like he's putting something in front of you that repulses you. If he can get you to simply allow a good thing to be the ultimate thing in your life, right? Then he'll distract you, move you away from your calling to follow God wholeheartedly. We must seek to crush those heart idols through consistent repentance in our life, through gospel formation that happens. Now, here's what I want to say about this idea. See, here's what's unfair in this whole conversation. When we elevate something or someone to the position of an idol in our life, where I'm seeking my ultimate fulfillment, joy, and satisfaction, we are unfairly placing an expectation on that target that can only be fulfilled in God. And that creates all kinds of problems. When I put my spouse in that place, guess what I'm doing? I'm creating a formula for absolute failure and disaster. I am putting on my spouse a burden that they were not created to bear. You guys know, I mean, Ash and I have an awesome relationship. We love each other dearly. If I make Ash my ultimate heart idol, guess what? She can't live up to that expectation. I for sure can't live up to that expectation if she puts me on that place in my life. She wasn't created for that. It is unfair to her for me to do that. It's unfair to my kids to make them the ultimate idol in my life. to place them in some place of superiority over God in my life. As awesome as it is to be a parent, as good as it is, as fun as it is, how much love that we have for our kids, if we elevate them to that ultimate place in our lives, we are placing on them a burden they were not created to bear. And they will disappoint, they will hurt, and we know what happens when that takes place, right? How things unravel. It's unfair to place them in that position. We must seek to crush the idols of our heart. Idols cannot satisfy. Idols will not satisfy. And this is a formula for disappointment, hurt, conflict at home, work, marriage. Only the Creator God of the universe can satisfy the human soul. So here's what I say to you. Enjoy God's creation in every way. His gifts are good and gracious gifts. Enjoy your spouse. Love your spouse deeply. Enjoy your kids. Love them deeply. But reserve your worship and devotion for God and God alone. And if you will do that, it will enable you to have a fulfilling, meaningful, satisfying relationship in the good and gracious gifts of God. I can love Ashley more effectively and deeply when I do not put that burden on her. I can love my kids more deeply and fully when I do not make them the ultimate thing in my life. It enables me to position them in a way where I can love them truly as God intends. That's how we were created. Enjoy God's creation. The Creator God who has redeemed us for His glory. Now, what enables us to do this, to have victory over these idols in our heart, is the finished work of Jesus. It is done. He said, it is finished. It is complete. We rest in the gospel. John Calvin, the theologian reformer, said, the human heart is a perpetual idol factory. It's constantly creating idols. It is prone to create idols in our heart. And that is why it is crucial for us to preach the gospel to ourselves daily, to rest in the finished work of Jesus each and every day, to put no other gods before Him. Commandment number 2. Verse 4, you shall not make for yourselves a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, that is in earth beneath, that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commands. The second commandment, this idea of not making images of God. The primary prohibition here builds on this first command, and it warns us against creating a kind of this false object to worship. Israel is not to identify or compare God with any created thing. The way that Paul phrased this in Romans chapter 1 is the idea of exchanging the glory of the immortal God for the images that resemble mortal being. So Paul says that spiritual idolatry of the heart in Romans 1 is trying to define the immortal God by mortal things. Israel's God is unlike the false gods of the other nations. He cannot be restricted or confined to human terms and explanations. He is bigger than our minds can comprehend. He is bigger than our words can define. Now, again, we think in terms of false gods of that day. They created idols, the sun god. It looked like this. It was a fish man or some other things that you see in ancient history of the idols that were created. That's how we tend to think of idols. What I would say to us is our idols simply look different. They're still physical beings often. They're still things that we attach God to, right? So it may be my bank account, it may be my pride, it may be my child, it may be my reputation, it might be some type of ideal family image that I got in my mind, that we live in a certain type house or drive a certain type of car, wear a certain type of clothes, or my kids go to a certain school. Like, we create all of these idols that are still idols around us. They just look different than they did for ancient Israel. And God says, when you are putting objects, human objects, in my place, he is warning against falling into that trap. of trying to define God on our own terms. Man, we love to do that, don't we? To define God on how we think God should look like. By the way, every time I've ever done that or had that conversation, isn't it crazy how God tends to look a lot like us? Tends to have the same political views I have. Tends to, you know, have the same ideas I have. We love to make God look a lot like us. And God says, do not limit me. He forbids us here from placing any likeness of anything on him. And his instructions here are pretty all-inclusive, aren't they? He's like, nothing from anywhere should ever be elevated to an object of worship. Highest high, highest highs, deepest hells, nothing should ever be created into an image of who God is. It is God and God alone who is worthy of our absolute devotion. Now, what about this word jealousy? God's jealousy is highlighted here. Now, don't make the mistake that this word jealous is what we tend to mean when we say jealous, which is related to the idea of envy. Like, don't equate it with the trivial way that we toss around that word when we think about, you know, people. My boyfriend is jealous of me, or my girlfriend is jealous, or my spouse is jealous of me, or things, or status, or like, he or she is just jealous. He or she's just jealous of what I have. They're just jealous of who we are as a family. Like, we love to throw that word around like that in a very trivial way. That's not God here. God's not some petty boyfriend or girlfriend that's jealous because you're chasing another idol. There's no idea of envy in the word jealousy that's used here. God's jealousy is righteous. It is a holy response to idolatry. God is passionately in love with his people, and he desires relationship with them. And idolatry disrupts that relationship. The idea of jealousy emphasizes how fervent God is about the flourishing of his people. That from the opening scenes of the Bible, he longs for his people to love him and know him, because it is in that harmonious relationship between the Creator and his creation where we find true fulfillment, true satisfaction, true joy. God is for us, and because he is for us, he desires what is best for us. And when he sees things creeping into our life that disrupts that idolatry, through idolatry, he is passionately, fervently, right, pushing toward a renewed relationship. That's the idea of jealousy here. It's clear in these verses how serious God takes this matter, right? He says, like, idolatry impacts generations of people, third and fourth generation. And he also says his love and his pursuit of his children is steadfast and ongoing. Third command, verse 7. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Now, I grew up kind of with the understanding that we tend to associate this command with the use of certain type of language, like foul language. And there is an implication here that God's name should be revered and honored and not treated flippantly or disrespectfully. But there's a deeper instruction here. The deeper instruction here has to do with who God is. You see, his name represents who he is, that he is the Lord our God. And particularly in Israel's culture in early generations, the name was representative of the essence of who the person is. And the idea behind this command is that God is to be valued. He is to be worshipped as the one true God, that he is worthy of our highest honor. You see, more importantly than the type of language that you use here, because a lot of us are like, well, I don't use that word, or I don't use GD, or whatever it is that we associate with this. Now, the idea here more is that we don't take lightly who God is. That's the bigger implication for us. It's not where run around allowing words to fly off the handle and everything going on, taking the Lord's name in vain. That's easy, right? The biggest implication for us is, am I treating God for who he really is? Or am I taking him lightly? The essence of who he is. Here's an interesting fact. Unlike us, God names himself. Anyone in here name yourself before you're born? Like, hey, I choose the name Devin. No, I was just like born, and Van and Sandy Hudson were like, Devin is your name. Like it, love it, hate it, want to walk away from it, whatever. Your name is Devin. I love the name Devin. I named my son Devin in the middle, Zachary Devin Hudson. And so I like my name. How many of you like your name? How many of you, not really crazy about my name? Okay, at least you're honest. What do you want us to call you? I'm just kidding. We're in that culture now, like you just pick whatever your name is or whatever. A lot of things you can just select on your own, I guess. God chose his own name. There's no like parents of God that was like, you will be Yahweh. No, it's like, I am. I am Yahweh, all these other names in the Bible, right? God just declares who he is. He's the only being in the entire universe that a name is not chosen for him. He just has a name. It is his name. And his name represents who he is. It represents his absolute authority. So when we talk about taking the Lord's name in vain, we are talking about not reflecting who God is, not representing God accurately in our everyday lives. Do not take who God is in vain. Do not treat it lightly. Understand who he is. Understand the essence of who he is. Don't dishonor that. Commandment number 4, the longest, by the way, explanation of any of the commands. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male servant, your female servant, your livestock, or the sojourner who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. So this is the idea of honoring the Sabbath day. This command is grounded in creation. Did you notice that? Like God did his work in 6 days and then he rested on the seventh. And this command maybe is our most difficult. This command, grounded in creation itself, is a call, listen, to intentionally and regularly hit the pause button on life and rest in who God is. That we are invited to remember God as creator and redeemer by observing Sabbath in our lives. There's tons of books and articles and opinions that you can read about what Sabbath looks like. Is it applicable to today? Is it Sunday? Is it not Sunday? What is it? There's a lot of teaching out there about that that you can dive into. But here's what we do know about Sabbath. Sabbath is a gift from God to us, and it reminds us that the sustainability of the world does not hinge on my work ethic. What? Some of you need to hear that. Whether the world keeps going doesn't hinge on your work ethic, on how hard you're going, how driven you are, what you're accomplishing. The world's going to go on if you can't work another day of your life. Remember the Sabbath and keep it holy. Man, how relevant is that message in our hurried culture? That God invites us out of the chaos of busyness and into the rest of his presence. To be intentional to stop and remember. Stop and remember. And so the question for us is, how are we intentionally practicing Sabbath in our life? Are we setting aside regular weekly time, because that's kind of how it's defined here. Are we setting aside regular weekly time to stop and rest and reflect and behold, that's the word I've used here at City Church some, to behold our God? Are you intentional to step out of the chaos and into the calm of his presence? By the way, to do that, you must turn down the noise. You got to turn down the noise. You got to put the phone down. You got to turn Netflix off. You got to stop worrying about Facebook. You got to turn down the noise. You got to stop searching YouTube videos. It's going to take you in a dark hole where you don't want to go. You got to turn down the noise. Temporarily, turn down the noise to hear from God. You got to stop prioritizing the chaos. Whatever that looks like, if it's ball games, if it's travel ball, if it's whatever we are so consumed with in our culture to practice Sabbath, we have to intentionally take a step back, hit pause, and be with God. Now, I'm not saying don't do all those things, right? I'm not saying don't have social media, don't have a phone, don't let your kids play sports. Like, we do all those things. But I can tell you, if we're not hitting pause regularly to stop and pull back and think and remember who we are and remember who He is, then we are violating what God's talking about here. Slow down, pause, reflect, think about how big I am. Did you know everything seems to line up in my life a little better when I am reflecting on how big He is and how little I am compared to Him? I can only do that if I pull out of the noise and listen. Remember who He is. Turn down the noise. Turn off the PS4 and listen to God. Reflect on who He is. These first four commands that we covered today, they have to do with our conduct toward God, don't they? Now, the final six that we'll look at next week, they focus on our relationship with others. But the six flow out of the four. That our vertical relationship with God empowers us to live out our horizontal relationships with others. When we understand who God is, what He has done, it impacts our everyday life and interaction with others. We will not disobey our parents or murder or commit adultery or steal or lie or covet if God is the ultimate in our lives. Love God. And then love people. Does that sound familiar? Love God, love people. What did Jesus say? Matthew 22. Smart aleck comes up to God or Jesus, like, "Don't write, you got it all figured out, Jesus. Tell me. What are the greatest commands?" I mean, by the time Jesus is walking the earth, it's like 650 plus commands coded into the idea of Old Testament law. Jesus, 650 plus commands. What are the greatest commands? What is the greatest command? How did Jesus respond? 27. He said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind. This is the great and first commandment. A second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend all the law and prophets." You want to know what the two big are? Love God, love people. Love God, love people. By the way, Paul says in the New Testament, the law is written on our hearts. You know what that means? Hear me closely. The Ten Commandments are less about monuments in front of courthouses and posted in schools and more about what's written on my heart. External conformity gets us nowhere in righteousness with God. The gospel is internal transformation. I am far more concerned about the gospel transforming you from the inside out and whether they're posted in front of the courthouse indicator. You understand me? I am far more concerned that God is doing His work in you and that you are living out what it means to love God and love others than where we have placed these things in some public place. I'm not saying that's wrong and that conversation is not healthy to have. What I'm saying is, ultimately, the law is written on our hearts. Love God, love others. How do we love God? Worship Him as He is the one and only true God. Tear down the idols in our life through gospel repentance, through gospel formation. Reflect on who God is by recalling what God has done. And the way to do that, be intentional to hit pause and rest in Him. The Ten Commandments instruct us on what it means to live life as a person who has been chosen, delivered, and redeemed by the one true God. Don't get Sinai before Exodus. And we'll talk about that later. Don't get Sinai before Exodus. The gospel reminds us we can't keep God's law. We're lawbreakers by our very nature. It is only through the finished work of Jesus that we are able to live out the grace that has been shown to us. So these Ten Commandments, they're not about trying harder to be a better person or citizen. They're about living the life of a redeemed child of God, which is a byproduct of our rescue. Love God with all of your heart, all of your soul, all of your mind, all of your strength. And that has been made possible by the one who is faithful and obedient on our behalf. Our obedience is grounded in his finished work. We love God supremely because he first loved us.